Who, me, what, again already? Doesn't seem like I'm always sitting here talking about stuff. All right, well, here I am again. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Happy to have you here. Our friend Sheldon Richman will be on a little bit later. We're going to talk economics. You know, I may hold him over. I have a dearth of interviewees today, and he's written some good stuff about Libya and very important subject matter there, so I may hold him over and do kind of a little bit about economics and libertarianism, and then a little bit about the empire as well, with the great Sheldon Richman from the Future of Freedom Foundation. He'll be on the show after just a little while. And man, I got so much news here to cover for you. I do my best to try to tell you what I think is important for you to know about, you know. That's why I'm here. So, yeah, I didn't really jot down notes. I think I'm just going to go through the tabs. I got a lot of tabs. You know, there's only one way that could possibly have this many tabs. Tab Kit 2nd Edition. And for some reason now, you have to get the Tab Kit highlighter separate. But I don't care. And now maybe that's, you know, giving the NSA a hole through my Mozilla. But at this point, I don't give a damn because I love the Tab Kit. What a wonderful invention. That means I can stack up all my tabs on the right side, and I can color code them all by category. Which usually is by region, you know, subject matter, NSA stuff, police stuff, and then Africa, Afghanistan, Syria, Ukraine sections, this kind of thing. You understand. So I don't know if, you know, in your work, you need that many tabs open all the time, but I sure as hell do, and it's the only way I can get away with it. And it's so great that I sort of feel like I owe it to you guys to let you know that there's such a thing. Tab Kit, 2nd Edition. And then you got to get the highlighter thing, too. That way the one that you're on is in black, and the ones you haven't looked at is highlighted in yellow. And the ones that you lock down and protect are dark green. Yeah, it's just great. It's great, the Tab Kit 2nd Edition. Whoever made it, thanks. If you have money, donate a dollar to whoever made it. Thanks. Okay, so today on the show, we do have Ukraine stuff. We've got Israel stuff. We got Russia, China. I'm trying to get Eric Margulies on the show to talk about Russia, China. So I'm going to put that off till later in case I do have our expert guest on to talk about that. But first of all, today, I want to start with a little bit of war on terrorism stuff. Yesterday, the House of Representatives, you may have heard this mentioned during the show yesterday, that they were debating the AUMF. And this was Obama's... You know, I never know... I didn't really take it seriously at the time. I never know how to take this guy seriously. Usually if Obama says something that, you know, he vows to do something horrible, I take his word for that. And if he vows to do the right thing, I don't really put any stock in it whatsoever. And so he gave a speech about a year ago saying, yeah, this and that, and shape up and make the war on terror less... move on from that era to something less worse, you know? And so here we are a year later. We got protesters in orange jumpsuits and black hoods today in Times Square protesting the fact that, well, there's Guantanamo Bay still open, as though the poor little commander-in-chief can't seem to figure out how to order those troops to move. Huh. It was like, I wanted to order the troops to move, but then no words would come out. And so Guantanamo is still open. President of the United States, everybody. And then he said he wanted to unwind the AUMF. Maybe replace it with something worse. Who knows, right? Not like you can trust him. But at least on the surface, he was saying that the authorization to use military force passed after 9/11, and which has been read so broadly as to justify any crime or any act of war anywhere in the world since then, that it's time to go. We can't, what are we going to do? We're going to do this forever? We have a war against any Sunni radical with a gun who would dare resist us anywhere in the world forever. Really? Yeah. They had a bill. Adam Schiff introduced a bill. A Democrat from California introduced a bill to repeal the authorization to use military force, and it failed. 191 to 233 in the House of Representatives yesterday. And I don't know. Well, let's see. Jason Ditz here writes, the bill had initially been seen as having some administration support, but that myth evaporated after yesterday's fiasco in the Senate, which would have been 2 days ago's fiasco in the Senate, where officials argued the AUMF had nothing to do with anything and that President Obama would attack whomever he pleased whenever he pleased. The officials came out for a vague, non-specific change to the AUMF, but not for repeal. This led Hawks to angrily condemn Representative Schiff's bill, with Representative Mac Thornberry from Texas accusing him of having forgotten 9/11. Oh. And it's not going anywhere in the Senate because Obama's back down. We already saw a taste of this the other day. I mentioned how it was half true, but look what's going on here. The national security state is leaking to Eli Lake that the president is basically guilty of treason if he wants to stop this war. There are Sunni radicals with guns out there. Arabs. And we can't stop killing them until they stop being radical Sunni Arabs with guns. And they're kind of telling the truth because, of course, George W. Bush increased the number of bin Ladenite types in the world by, 1,000% or so. And then Obama has come and not only doubled down on that by backing the Mujahideen wars in Libya and in Syria, but has spread them geographically all the way down, clear into Nigeria, in West Africa, but not even just West Africa, but, you know, midway on the latitude there, too. I mean, spread from Libya down into Mali and down into Nigeria, and Boko Haram was already there, but now they're worse. As Brendan O'Neill was talking about on the show, and he had some great references too, for how the Boko Haram guys really did go and train with and become allied with and weaponized by the jihadis that followed the Tuareg rebellion in Mali and who had come with weapons won in the war against Gaddafi, Obama's war against Gaddafi. So it's true that he has created a lot of enemies. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that the U.S. military or the CIA should do anything about it. I think it's a fact. It's like a scientific truth that the worst we should allow our government to do on this is use the cops to arrest these guys and prosecute them or help the Europeans to do it or whatever. Keep them isolated in the Middle East as best you can. And then the truth of it is that the bin Ladenite types, everywhere they go, for example, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, people hate their guts. Their grassroots support in the neighborhood, boy, it dries up real quick because, what, they're bin Ladenites. They're horrible. They go around cutting people's heads off, threatening to cut everybody else's head off, and people just, that's it. You know, in Iraq, they went around trying to ban smoking cigarettes and punishing people for, ridiculous things, conscripting their sons. And the Sunni Iraqis were like, hey, you're not even from here, dude. You're not conscripting my son. I'll shoot you in the head first. Watch. And then did. And then that was more or less the end of al-Qaeda in Iraq for a little while there. They took a breather, but then Maliki, I already won and took all policy. Really solidified, and with the war that Obama backed in Syria, the Mujahideen war in Syria, where America's on the side of the Islamic State of Iraq, and now it's called and Syria, that has, of course, helped, as Patrick Coburn has said on the show, to help re-energize the Sunni insurgency and the al-Qaeda insurgency in Iraq. So the CIA dudes have a point that Obama, they wouldn't put it this way, Obama has made it so that there are so many of these bin Ladenite enemies in the world that it makes it very difficult for him to go ahead and support any push in the Congress to repeal this authorization, this Gulf of Tonkin resolution for unlimited war, this blank check of really blank authority, not just not just authorization for, you know, like Vietnam on a blank check, but anywhere in the world on a blank check. Makes it very difficult to repeal it. Don't you know there's a war on? Hell, even anti-war radio says that there are thousands of these bin Ladenites. What are we going to do about them? And so, there you go. And the war will keep going on. Forever and ever. For decades at least. Cheney's grim vision. That's what they called it. It was an editorial in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer back when it was like few and far between and brave of them to say, wow, everybody, look. Cheney's saying that we are in this for the long haul. Decades of war. The long war before they ever started calling it the long war. Cheney's grim vision, and that's where we're living right now. And when it comes to, if you watched the PBS Frontline thing on the NSA, the best part of it was the way they explained the continuity of the program. It's one big wiretap everything program ever since September 11th, really even before, according to some people, but especially since September 11th. And then they've come up with every different kind of legal justification that they can think of in the world. And the authorization to use military force has been part of that. Just as well as they've cited it for their crimes, really, holding people without trial and starting wars against Yemen, Somalia. And the first real push to repeal it yesterday in the House of Representatives failed.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
All right, you guys, I'm Scott Horton, and man, this one, I'm going to try to keep it cool here, but it does so happen that when I read this article last night, I got all pissed off. I can't believe this, man. It's in the top news section at antiwar.com today, and I can believe it. I mean, I don't know. I just, indignation words. A general writes the first after-action report on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Which, by the way, the war in Afghanistan is not over. But still. Why we lost. After 35 years in uniform, retired three-star says he will explain where U.S. war strategy failed. It's about this new book, Why We Lost, by Lieutenant General Daniel Bulger of the U.S. Army. And the bottom line is simply the way he puts it in just, you know, from the military point of view's terms, we should have gone in there and knocked off the Taliban and then left. We should have gone in there and knocked off Saddam Hussein and then left. Why in the hell did we think we could stay? Why in the hell did we think that our army was made for or could possibly be up to the task of creating a whole new society for people? This is ridiculous. And then the part that makes me so mad in here is about how, like, on one hand, he condemns people who would have warned you all along. He admits people warned us all along. Or he half concedes it by saying exactly the kind of things that people who warned him said, like, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires. Can't you learn the lesson of the Russians and the British and not do this to yourself? Why do you think that Brzezinski bragged that luring the Soviets into Afghanistan in 1979 and 1980 was a magnificent ploy against Russia? Not for Russia. Brzezinski wasn't a pro-Soviet traitor. Brzezinski was luring the Soviets into the quicksand so they would drown and die. Can't you learn the lessons of the lesson you already learned and applied to your enemy in that land? No, you got to go ahead and do it to yourself too. And, oh, but screw you for claiming that you warned me, he writes. How were we supposed to know? But what's important now is that we learn the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan, that maybe we just shouldn't send in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people to fight land wars in Asia, to wage war against the populations of civilians who would dare resist our permanent occupations of their land. Blame it all on Mohammed motivating them to be evil or whatever crap excuse to call them all terrorists for daring to be nationalist patriots in their own land. You know what we need, guys? We need a long, hard look at this. I think what we need to do is we need to get outside the box, maybe synergize and do a study, and we'll call out the intelligence dudes, and we'll think about it a little bit, and maybe, possibly, there could be some lessons, and, what exactly, out of counterinsurgency doctrine is really worth saving? Can we really claim to be a success? And I'm sorry, man, that, like, maybe, is it just personal that it seems to me like in here they should say, hey, man, and you know what? Apologies to the guys at antiwar.com who told us all along that we were wrong, that we were stupidly, horribly, terribly, self-destructively wrong, that we were spreading bin Ladenite terrorism across the Middle East, that we were putting the Shiites in power in Baghdad, which was only giving the Saudis that much more incentive to back the bin Ladenites everywhere else. And on and on and on and on. Oh, who would have thought? Who would have thought? How about this loser nobody cab driver in September of 2001? I remember I had Bob Cole, who was one of the most famous radio voice personalities in Texas. I don't know if he's still around or what, but he did the morning show on the FM country station here in town. And in Austin, Texas, that's where I'm out of here. And, oh boy, was he one of these right-wing Republican, George Bush sucking, know-nothing, know-it-all, blowhard warmongers in sometime September 2001, and I had him in my cab and said, no, see, the country's the size of Texas, but it's shaped like Colorado. It's all mountains, and the tribesmen there, they like to fight, and they have weapons, and you cannot win in Afghanistan. You can hunt down your enemies and kill them, but you think that Afghanistan's going to be American property from now on and all this tough talk? Wrong. And who was I except some nobody, nothing, skater kid? But that's right, any idiot who didn't have a vested interest in being wrong coulda told you and did. Just Raimondo, go read his archives from the fall of 2001. He has one called Kill 'Em and Get Out, and then gives all of the reasons why to not stay. You know, same thing with Iraq. Go read what Colleen Rowley, remember the heroic Justice Department FBI whistleblower who wrote the letter to the Senate about the Moussaoui case? She was the lawyer from the Minneapolis office who was denied the opportunity to ask the FISA judge for a rubber stamp warrant to search Zacharias Moussaoui's belongings, which would have stopped the attack, which they would have found the phone numbers that led directly to the Al-Qaeda cell in Florida of Mohammed Atta, the leader, and a few of the other more important, you know, the pilot hijackers. That would have been the end of the 9/11 plot if they had let these cops do their job with the power they already had. Hey, the flight school turned him in. This guy wants to fly the biggest jet. We can teach him how to fly, but he doesn't really care about taking off or landing. He just wants to know how to crash it into something. You know, one of the FBI agents in her office actually wrote down in an email or in a memo that I'm afraid this guy wants to somehow worm his way onto a flight from Heathrow to New York and then crash into the World Trade Center, he wrote. It's a pretty obvious target. And anyway, Colleen Rowley, so she blew the whistle in the spring of 02, a year before the invasion of Iraq. And then once she went public, I forget if this was in her original letter to the Senate or just in statements she made later, but she was saying, man, don't invade Iraq. You are going to spread terrorism all over the world. Hell, Hosni Mubarak, Hillary Clinton's family friend, Uncle Sam's tiny little bitch, military dictator of Egypt for 30 years, said, please don't do this, Uncle Sam. You're going to ruin everything, dude. You're going to create 10,000 bin Ladens. The king of Saudi Arabia said, don't do this. It used to be you and me and Saddam against the Iranians. And now you are going to hand Iraq to Iran on a golden platter, he said. Not a silver platter, a golden one. And of course, in case you don't remember, they had spies inside the highest levels of the Hussein government who were telling them, and they believed it. They knew that it was true, that he had no weapons and that he was prepared to surrender everything, go into exile and everything else. But they wouldn't let him do it. They wouldn't accept surrender. They met with Richard Pearl in England, and Saddam Hussein promised to give up everything. He said, send in the FBI and the army and the CIA. You can search anywhere you want for the weapons. I'll hold elections. I'll give up all my mineral rights to all my oil. I'll stop all support for Hamas and Hezbollah. Please don't kill me. His emissary begged Richard Pearl, and Richard Pearl said, see you in Baghdad. Boy, there's a guy who ought to be at the end of a rope hanging. I wonder if Richard Pearl even let George Bush and the administration know that that had happened, that the Iraqis had made that offer. Not that Bush would have taken him up on it, I don't believe. But still, in fact, that's bad. Refusing to accept that surrender before the war. And anyway, so there you go. Scott Horton was right. Nothing, nobody, skater, cab driver was right all along, and everyone with power and influence was wrong and horribly, stupidly wrong, and so wrong and horrible, and got so many people killed that there ought to be just an absolute massacre of suicides in Washington, D.C. The blood on the hands of these know-nothing know-it-alls, these power-mongering liars and knaves, I mean, fools, really. Look what they've done. Look what they've done. A general writes the first after-action report on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Why we lost. We tried to do something that was stupid and impossible. Because, go ahead and say it, Lieutenant General, because you're stupid. You got a lot of people killed. Hundreds of thousands of people killed. Because you're stupid. Because you did something that anyone could have and did tell you not to do in the first place. Start a war. Who are you, the Imperial Japanese? Start a war? You have to be told that it's wrong to start a war? To occupy someone else's country for a decade? It's amazing that these people can just, I mean, where's the shame in this? There's no shame in it at all. It's jaw-dropping, right? It's time that someone would dare even give this honest assessment in 2014. in 2014. Anyway, here's some parts of commercials. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Welcome back to the show, guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest on the show today is the great Sheldon Richmond. Oh, I lost him after 2 seconds. Well, it's going to work. We're gonna work this out. We're sitting here trying to call each other on Skype, and it's not working. Okay, now we're going to try again here. All right, we got him now, everybody. It's the heroic Sheldon Richmond. He's the vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation, and he's the editor of their monthly journal, The Future of Freedom, which you can subscribe to at fff.org/subscribe. And it's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and highly worth it. And you get to help support a great libertarian institution that features the best writers in the libertarian universe. So that's at fff.org/subscribe. And yes, they do pay me a pittance to say that, but that's all right, too, because it's no conflict, because as you well know, back when I was only paid by antiwar.com and not much at that, I still interviewed Sheldon and the FFF guys all the time because, yeah, they're my boys. So there you go. And Wendy, too. I like her. Hey, welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Nice
okay, good. Appreciate you joining us today and appreciate you writing things for me to read, too. Let's talk about Keynes. I think it's sort of the premise of your article today that at least there's plenty of reason for people to have plenty of problems with John Maynard Keynes and his economic prescriptions, I guess his diagnoses and prescriptions. And yet you're saying despite any problem that anybody has with him, everybody has got to concede that others really like this guy and they like believing in him. And so I guess that indicates that either there really is something to it or there at least is really something to why people like believing in him even though he's wrong. So first of all, please describe kind of thumbnail about Keynesian economics, you know, the general theory, diagnosis, and prescription in a thumbnail, what might be wrong with it. I know you disagree. And then, you know, tell us why it is that people still like it all anyway, if it's so off base.
Well, Keynes was a John Maynard Keynes, also Lord Keynes, was a very well known and eminent intellectual in Great Britain, even before the Great Depression. But when the Great Depression came along, he published a book in 1936 called The General Theory, although in a funny way, he described his own book as not really a general theory, but as something addressing the times. And the times meant was, you know, the depth of the Great Depression, 25% unemployment in the United States, a huge drop in production. And so there were, you had stagnation and not very good times, obviously. So he writes this book, which is trying to explain why there could be chronic unemployment in a market economy. You know, the previous economists, the classical school, the Austrian school, and others, you know, always talked in terms of an economy that could rejuvenate itself. If it got into trouble, it contained its own forces of correction, especially if the government got it into trouble by, you know, printing money and doing other things. If it was left alone, the market would regenerate itself. In other words, people acting. The market doesn't act, only people act. So when I say the market rejuvenates itself, I mean that people taking appropriate responses to the problems going on around them, reshuffle resources and put them more in line with consumer demand, and therefore we can talk in terms of the economy fixing itself. So he proposed a way to end, get economies out of their ruts, namely ending chronic mass unemployment. But he wasn't much concerned with what got the economy into the rut in the first place. When the Austrians would talk about that, Hayek was one of the Keynes's main nemesis, probably the main nemesis. Hayek wanted to talk about what caused depressions, what caused the business cycle. Keynes wasn't interested in that. He said, let's just talk about what to do about it. You would think that how the economy got into the mess would give us some guide to how to get out of it. But he didn't believe that. He just thought, no, let's not talk about what might cause depressions. Let's just talk about getting out of depression. So he proposed, of course, printing money and government spending, because he thought the problem was insufficient demand in the economy for workers and for goods, and therefore that's why there was not much activity going on, and why people were so badly, for long term, out of work for such a long time. However, as Larry White explains, my article really based on a chapter in a very good book by Larry White called The Clash of Economic Ideas, which goes over back the last 100 years of controversies in economics. And Larry's writing from an Austrian perspective. The problem with Keynes, the reason why it hung on, was at the moment that Keynes was writing in 1936, when things looked so bad, although things had been improving a little bit, they'd been turned down again in 1937. There was a depression within the depression in 1937. But the reason that it hung on was, according to Larry and according to other people, Milton Friedman and others, was Keynes seemed to give hope. He seemed to be saying, we could do something right away to make things good by getting, we can get people back to work by government spending and, public works and printing money and stuff like that. And the Austrians, Hayek and others, were saying, no, the economy really has to cleanse itself of all the errors that were committed because government was printing money and holding interest rates artificially low in the 20s. You got to give it time to work things out. Well, this idea of you got to give it time seemed to be telling people, look, it's going to be a mess for a while, so just get used to it. While Keynes was saying, no, we can fix it right away. And even when the Austrians would say, wait a second, fixing it right away is going to set the stage for the next bust, they got poo-pooed, saying, go away. You're just naysayers. You're just gloom and doomers. We can do something today, and you guys are just standing in the way. And that's one reason why Keynes's ideas have held on for so long. Anytime there's a crisis, of course, politicians want to make things look good fast because – there may be an election coming up, or they don't want to lose support in the polls. So you can see the appeal of something, do something. We had to do something, and therefore anything qualifies because it's something, right?
In the Great Depression, you got people really starving to death. And so it's nice for some fancy guy in a fancy house and a fancy suit with a fridge full of food to talk about how we just have to grin and bear it when he's not having to bear a damn thing. But of course, there's probably wasn't a single person who knew better than to do what they wanted to do, who wasn't in that position, right? So if you got a belly full of nothing, you're eating dirt, and some millionaire is telling you that, oh no, if we try to feed you, that's going to screw up the pricing system. You're going to want to cut his throat and eat him.
Well, that's right. And look, economics is not simple. It's not intuitive. And, average people don't pay attention to it. Most of them don't ever study it. The ones that study it don't remember anything after the final exam, where they were taught bad Keynesian economics anyway. So most people aren't going to understand that. That's right. So the snake oil salesman in politics, who has a court economist like, Keynes by his side, can say, look, do you want to go with me, who will do something right away? Or do you want to go with that guy who says, no, the economy's got to work out these errors? It's going to take time, and it's going to take the long run. That's why Keynes said, it was in the previous book, but that's why Keynes made the famous statement, in the long run, we're all dead. Mm-hmm. It didn't so much mean that the long run doesn't matter. and let's only look at the short run. That's not really what he was saying in that book, an earlier book on the Treatise on Money. He was saying we can't wait for the long run. You know, he felt the classical economists and the Austrians were saying, look, things will work out in the long run. And he was saying, wait a second, a lot of us are going to be dead by the time the long run comes along. We can't wait for that. So, at the surface, Keynes seems to win, and that's why I think that's why he did win. I think another thing that helped Keynes' case was that he gave intellectual cover for what the politicians wanted to do anyway, right, which was borrow, spend, and print money.
Right.
So he gave them an intellectual aura. Hey, now, look, this big-shot economist in Britain says it's the right thing to do, that we do all these otherwise crazy things.
Right.
So I think that's one reason why it's popular to this day. And look, you can turn on Chris Matthews or any of these people on really any of the stations, and if you listen to some pundit give economic analysis, chances are it's going to be Keynesian. The government needs to spend. I mean, Chris Matthews every day is saying, why isn't the government building roads and putting people back to work by building, fixing bridges and all this stuff? And he once accused, more than once, has accused people who don't believe in Keynesian economics as not believing in science. He says, if you're anti-Keynes, you're just anti-science, which means you probably also don't believe there's man-made catastrophic global warming, and you probably also don't believe in evolution. He put all
God
that together.
Somebody save us from Chris Matthews. Yeah. All right. Now, so here's the thing. Let me try to play devil's advocate here a little bit, which is that the reason there was a giant bust was because there had been a gigantic program of welfare for rich people in the 20s. This giant bubble wasn't a bubble for the little guy. It was a bubble for the rich guys. And then they busted it so bad, and then they screwed up everything, you know, with their giant tariffs and everything else. It was the rich and powerful who did all the things that caused the Depression that made it worse all along, and who had socialism for them since the days of Alexander Hamilton and the Federalist Party. And, you know, the John Adams administration, come on, let's do some internal improvements, which means transfer money from the taxpayer to their friend, the banker, or their relation, the banker, more likely. And so it seems like, you know, obviously I just want to abolish the whole damn everything myself, but I can, I have a lot of sympathy for the argument that since we do live in a world where there is a USA, and since it always gave welfare to the rich, that by the 20th century, the poor kind of sort of had a point in saying, at least give us back some of our own money in the form of old age pensions, or maybe build us a highway or something that's going to benefit the rest of us, too, since you're stealing and printing money anyway. And now it's the break. But we'll be right back with Sheldon Richman and the possibility of good government spending right after this.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there.
All right. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Sheldon Richman. He's about as libertarian as hell, man. He's the vice president of Future Freedom Foundation. He's got this article today about why people want to keep believing in Keynes. So I'm doing my best to impersonate one of them. Hey, what about it? How about the idea, Sheldon, that the U.S. government has always been Keynesian in terms of military Keynesianism and in terms of stimulating bankers' pockets and, you know, railroad owners and this kind of thing. And so it's only fair for them to stimulate broader sectors of the economy and especially do things like build massive highway systems and useful bridges and dams and old age pensions for our grandparents so they don't all have to just lay down and die once they're too old to work and that kind of thing. So how about that?
Yeah, but if Keynes's proposals, which are based on a fallacious view of the economic process, are wrong, then they're wrong no matter what the objective is. So you can't pay back the people who have been unjustly treated by using the same kind of policies except directed at them. The whole problem with as White explains in the chapter, Keynes basically threw out well over 100 years, almost 200 years worth of knowledge about how economies work. He basically said, well, economies don't work. There are no economic forces really that lead to coordination and general prosperity. That's why governments are going to usually be needed to help it along, because if demand falls, government's going to need to step in and be the spender of last resort. So he was wrong about that. So his solutions stem from fallacy, and so they're going to be wrong even if they're intended to help the masses rather than to help the privileged.
All right. Well, but then, so if it is taken as a given that whatever the excuse is, whether it's to try to, you know, whether they call it counter-cyclical stimulus spending to make up for the last boom and bust that they had caused or whatnot, still, what's the overall argument that it's that bad for the economy, for example, to have a Social Security program, which so many people love so damn much?
Well, Social Security isn't specific, distinctively Keynes. I mean, Social Security begins with Bismarck, Otto von Bismarck, in the late 19th century in Germany, as a way to keep workers loyal to the ruling party and to the emperor, rather than being tempted by either the liberal party or the Marxist party. So that's not distinctively Keynes. Keynes ultimately wanted a socialization of investment. He thought that the government, which of course means economists hired by the government, maybe people like him, would be determining where investment would be made. He thought ideally the interest rate should be zero so that the capital would be unlimited. But politicians, and like I said, and their economic advisors would be directing the capital. But that circumvents the market. The virtue of the free market is that entrepreneurs and others have to take their lead from consumer demand, which is reflected in prices. Mm-hmm. And prices do their work by channeling scarce resources and labor services to where consumers want it most. And also, part of what the consumer demand consists of is their time preference. In other words, the intensity of their wish for present goods over future goods. And there are times when people begin to save and put the money away, and like for instance in a bank or other forms of investment, which is then those resources that are then available for building up early stages of production. Mining and research and development and factories that are way down the line that won't produce consumer goods for some time. Keynes ignores all that, like the time structure of production, and acts like it's all simultaneous. He thought savings was a bad thing because he thought it wasn't being spent. If it's not being spent, firms, stores won't reorder, and therefore there'll be unemployment. He didn't seem to understand, although White shows that he earlier in his career understood that when people save, the money isn't just like stuffed in a mattress. That's not how people save. They would put it in the bank or in some other form of investment, which is then makes resources and labor available to earlier stages of production that won't yield consumer goods for a while. When people save, they're basically saying, I'm going to put off consuming. I'm going to save now so I can consume more in the future. That's why people save. They don't just do it out of animal spirits, which seems to be Keynes's view. Right. So it's a total. It's
well, that's
a total
funny that he even denies or just ignores the fact that people are going to go to the loan and take out other people's savings and spend it on building up their new company, which is supposed to turn a profit and continue producing more wealth.
He was looking at things from the trough of the Depression. So he thought, well, why would anybody do that? There's already unemployed people and unemployed resources. Why is savings going to help that? But he didn't care to even investigate what caused that all that unemployment in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it was all the malinvestment that was brought about by the government artificially holding down interest rates as a favor to businesses, it's true, and creating money, which misshapes the economy. The economy no longer now is lined up with consumer demand.
Well, and by the way, back then, how much of a mystery was that really? Because, I guess the best I understand that is, as I've read it in Bob Higgs and the way he explained it, that especially starting in 27, they really started cranking up the money supply to help the Bank of England helped the English because Benjamin Strong and what's his, Montague Norman, had such a close relationship, and basically Benjamin Strong was bailing out his friend at the Bank of England by debasing the American currency extra. But then, so that led directly to this giant stock market bubble and the crash and the crisis. And then, but was that really so opaque to Keynes and to everybody else at the time, other than Ludwig von Mises, or what?
Well, no, Hayek and others were warning about this. So it wasn't opaque. They just didn't see it as a problem. They didn't see it, sort of like living through it right now,
when we're living on the other side of the 08 bus and people still deny that the Austrians had any idea what they were talking about when they were warning all the time leading up to it.
Well, that's right. And the dominant opinion in 2008 was that, this had nothing to do with government policy. This was all the result of selfish mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers.
And is it true, too, that, as David Stockman says, that the Great Depression was actually already over before Franklin Roosevelt was even sworn in, when you look at the stats, that the way all investment was going, et cetera?
I don't know if it's the case. I don't think it's the case that before he's sworn in, but there's certainly improvement by 36 or 37. But then the Fed does some things that put things back down again. Like it increased reserve requirements, even though there were a lot of excess reserves, and it did some other things to cause the double dip. It was improving, but don't forget Hoover and the early years of Roosevelt were full of intervention. I mean, Hoover was jawboning companies not to drop wage rates, even though prices were falling like crazy. But they kept wages up, and that just created unemployment, mass unemployment. And then Roosevelt comes in and cartelizes the economy with the National Recovery Administration and the Agricultural Adjustment Act. So there's intervention all over the place, which turned what might have been a quick recession. After all, the recession of 2021 was relatively quick. The government basically retrenched. It cut spending. It cut, I don't know if it cut taxes, but Hoover raised taxes. So they did everything to prevent a recovery. And yet, it's just to show you how powerful even the remnant of the market can be, there was improvement through the 30s until the Fed stepped in again and basically shrank the money supply, which then pushed everything over again. And then, you also get the Smoot-Hawley tariff that was signed by Hoover in the 30. You get all kinds of the market has all kinds of things being thrown at it. So it really didn't have a chance to recover. It's amazing that it recovered to the extent that it did. Hmm.
Yeah. I need to get David Stockman on. I haven't read the book. It's just vast. But one of the things I read in one of these articles, or I guess it was the transcript of a speech that he gave, was that if you look at these and those numbers, there was already vast improvement before FDR even finally got there. And then he immediately set about making everything worse. And I think he's a Rothbardian on Hoover, too. I don't think he was discounting the damage that Hoover had done, but he was saying, look, the recovery was already on anyway.
Well, people do things and try to, in effect, create a recovery just by trying to, scale down their businesses and make them more lean in bad times. And those sort of things aid recovery. But the government kept throwing up obstacles. Unemployment was still quite high when Roosevelt was inaugurated. So I don't know how much of an improvement there was.
Hey, let me ask you this. You got more free time this afternoon?
Actually not. I got a bunch of things I have to get out before this day ends.
Oh, that's too bad. I was going to see if I could keep you one more segment. We could talk about the economics of intervention overseas, but I think I got a little rant of my own coming, so it'll be all right.
Okay.
But all right, everybody. So that's Sheldon Richman. The article is at fff.org. His The Goal is Freedom. That's TGIF. The Goal is Freedom every Friday at fff.org. And this one is called Immortal Keynes. Oh, say it ain't so. Thanks very much, Sheldon. Good to talk to you again.
Okay, great talking to you, Scott.
Appreciate it. And we'll be right back after this horrible, lying, dishonest war propaganda from Fox News. Whatever it is that they're trying to get you to believe is 99% probably not correct, and so don't. But it's a great time filler while you guys go to the bathroom, change lanes, shift gears, whatever you got to do, and we'll see you back on the other side of this break. It's the Scott Horton Show.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one.
But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And by the way, you may have missed it yesterday. I told you. I'll tell you again. Starting on Monday, I'm going back to the Liberty Radio Network live. It'll be from 11 to 2 Central, 12 to 3 Eastern. And I'll still be on Daily Paul Radio and Anomaly Radio and APS Radio News and ScottHorton.org and as many places as I can, I guess, you know. Yeah, going back to LRN. So that'll be good. That's a good audience, and they're on a good satellite, so maybe if I actually do the work, I could try to syndicate the show out a little better. I haven't been very good at the business end of this thing, and, well, I'll see what I can do. LRN's a good thing. I never did have a beef with them whatsoever. When I left LRN, there was nothing wrong other than I wanted to be on No Agenda with no commercials. Because I could be on No Agenda with no commercials. But then I needed to have commercials anyway. So, the point became kind of moot. I wonder if I'm even on No Agenda at all anymore. Do they play the interviews or anything anymore? I guess probably not. Anyway, so I'm going back to LRN, LRN.fm, starting on Monday, and the new old time again, earlier in the day, 11 to 2 Central, 12 to 3 Eastern. Sorry if that screws you up for listening to the show on your shift at work or whatever. Anyway, so that's that. All right, good. So, man, I got all this other stuff to talk about. I guess I better get to talking about it so that you know. The U.S., if you ain't heard, has sent 80, they claim, soldiers to Chad. They already have a drone base there in Niger and in Chad, right? In order to hunt and kill jihadists that they spread from Libya down into Mali. And now they're sending 80 more soldiers to Chad to help for the hunt for the schoolgirls. Would somebody just forget this out of the damn news headlines so that the Empire will stop pretending to care for a minute? Who the hell wants to mess around with a war in Africa other than the Pentagon? Oh, well, yeah, the Empire cares so much about 200 missing girls that they just... Wait, what? Yeah. Yeah, they care so much about 200 missing girls they're going to go... They're sending the army. I guess we'll have a Camp Bondsteel-type permanent presence there before too long. You know what? I guess the base for Mali was just in Niger, not in Chad, now that I think about it. This would be a new base. I don't know if they're already in Chad or not. I never can get Nick Turse on the show. I wish I could interview Nick Turse for half an hour, 5 days a week on this show. So, Nick, what's the JSOC doing in Africa this week? Hey, Nick, tell us a story about JSOC in Africa. Hey, Nick, tell us the whole story about JSOC in Africa. That's what I would ask him. I would say, hey, Nick, tell us about the U.S. Army in Africa. Big continent. What is it, 60-something countries there or something? 70-something? Maybe more than that. There's only 190-something in the whole world, and Africa's got a lot of them, so... Anyway, major low-level invasion. I call it low-level because mostly they're just, you know, bribing their way in. It's not the old-school kind of colonialism. It's neo-colonialism, where they go in mostly with briefcases...
and soldiers to train your officers and to make them proxies of our government. That's right. Get in line. Kidnapped girls. Kidnapped girls who got kidnapped. Did you hear that some girls got kidnapped? By the way, you should know. And I didn't even realize this myself. But it does turn out, and Brendan O'Neill, if you read what Brendan O'Neill wrote about Nigeria and the Boko Haram thing last week, you'll see he's got these links to these studies pointing out about just how much of an effect the war in Mali had on the war in Nigeria, and how Boko Haram had actually at one time been a peaceful group. And I think they started resorting to violence. I'm not sure when, and I am sure it was in reaction to the Nigerian government cracking down on them, massacring the people in their part of the country. They resorted to violence. But then when the Americans came and liberated the Mujahideen of Libya, and then they spread their war down into Mali, they hooked up with these Boko Haram guys and armed them and trained them. And, you know, they all swung around on the monkey bars together, like in the file footage, and it was really terrifying. And apparently, there was, from people, you know, who really study Boko Haram, there was a marked change in their behavior as a group after that, for the worse, meaning a higher pile of bodies of innocent people, and turn them into a real problem. And this is going to be a real problem for the long-term future in Africa, where all of these state borders were drawn by the Europeans in order to separate the tribal relations from each other, in order to empower minorities over majorities so that they'll need the foreign support to keep them in power, keep them loyal, and this kind of thing. And they carved up the entire continent this way. And then they kept it that way for what, like 150 years? 100 years? From the time they had the ability to do so until after the Second World War. And so, it's the curse of the old world. It's the curse of humanity, man. All this tribalism and crap. It means that there are a lot of people who are the majority or the minority within their certain state, and that gives them advantages and or disadvantages over the others, and so they fight about it. And then institutionalized democracy, and you might just make everything worse by empowering the majority in ways they didn't have power before. So it's just going to be a mess for a long, long time to come. In other words, there's always going to be 400 missing girls in Africa, man. Always. If that's the only excuse the U.S. government needs to send the army, then, well, yeah, then you already know how that ends. It's going to be like this forever. As long as it's okay with us that our government has an army jobs program called Take Over Every Military in Africa. And turn it into a proxy. And take their stuff. And try your best to keep the Chinese out. It's madness. But, geez. You know, it's funny because after Iraq, starting a war against a helpless third world country that everybody knew was a helpless third world country, Ron Paul said before the war, they haven't been able to shoot down a single one of our planes bombing their country for 12 years in a row now. And at the same time, they're the greatest threat to the United States of America? Come on. Not really. You guys know that that's not true. But with that, hell, now, I mean, with a precedent like Iraq, now they can just... They can do a war in Libya. Nobody even knows. I was talking to a guy, said to me, there was a war in Libya? He didn't even hear about it. They had a whole war in 2011. It's not that he knew and then forgot. It's that he hadn't thought about Gaddafi in 10 years. He didn't know he was supposed to. He didn't even know it even happened. No one around him was even discussing it at all. Yeah, it was just an air war. It's not like they sent in an entire Iraq-sized invasion. They sort of outsourced a lot of it to the French. and the British and Special Forces and Al-Qaeda. And so, you know, what's to report? What's the big deal anyway? Humanitarianism. Obama said that Gaddafi was going to murder, in case you didn't notice, in 2011. Obama claimed that Gaddafi was going to kill 100,000 people. Not that he had, but that he was going to kill 100,000 people, every man, woman, and child in Benghazi, if the U.S. didn't stop him with a curtain of carpet bombs. And a lot of people bought that, including Lande, who is such a great journalist. I respect him anyway, but Lande bought into that. Juan Cole bought into that hook, line, and sinker. Ended up becoming a spokesman for the administration on it, de facto. Amy Goodman, too. Anyway. And now there's a coup in Libya. Apparently a CIA coup in Libya to try to undo the damage of empowering Ansar al-Sharia and empowering al-Qaeda in Iraq. Basically, that's who they are. They're the veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. They fought under Zarqawi's command in Iraq. At any time in the years between 2004 and 2010, our government would have called them al-Qaeda in Iraq. Including, you know, this guy Bill Hodge was actually kidnapped and abducted and CIA, MI6, tortured. Renditioned to Thailand and tortured for being an associate of Al-Qaeda. Then they shipped him back to Gaddafi, tortured him some more in prison. Then he got out and then Obama fought a war for the guy. To put him and his friends in power. I'm not saying that they should have done what Bush did and kidnap him and torture him, but I'm saying you don't have to fight a war for him instead. Why the hell is it that those are our only choices? To either, bomb Al-Qaeda's enemies and create a giant battlefield and safe haven for them, or directly fight them, fight for them. It seems like we could just not torture them or regime change on their behalf. Right? Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right. Welcome back to the show. So here, let me try to move through the news here. I got a lot of it for you. Moving on from Al-Qaeda, North Africa, and all of that. Here, IAEA report, again, to confirm Iran abiding by nuclear deal. We'll also detail agreement on investigation. So, in other words, everything's going fine, except that they ain't got a final deal yet, but they're still talking, and that's good. And, well, I don't know everything about it, but I read some tweets by some pretty plugged-in reporters. Laura Rosen was one of them, and I know she's still on this beat. And I can't remember who all she was tweeting back and forth with. Oh, Jasmine Ramsey, our friend from Jim Loeb's blog there as well. And what they were talking about was how it's sort of a sign of frustration and maybe there's a problem here. But on the other hand, it's also a positive sign, too, diplomatically speaking, that they're saying, you know what, we're kind of at an impasse. We need to break back into bilateral talks. Meaning that, the deal that they... So the bad news is the deal that they worked out in Oman is not quite, you know, final. They haven't put the finishing touches on it. They don't have... They're not really eye to eye on the final agreement, and perhaps even they're worried that they're not going to be able to get this now. The good news is it looks like they still want it. Both sides still want this nuclear deal, and that they're willing to go back into bilateral talks in order to work it out. This whole thing, of course, with the P5 plus one the UN Security Council plus Germany, you know, on one side of the negotiations and Iran on the other. You know, it's true. Russia has their own interest in keeping Iran from making nuclear weapons, and the Europeans, I guess, do too. But really, this is America's beef, because the Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans, they don't really lie about it, and they don't really believe their own lie that Iran is making nukes. It's the Americans on behalf of the Israelis who have the problem here. And so I think Phil Giraldi said on this show that when the French pretended to object for a couple of weeks, delaying even the interim deal last fall, that they were pretending, that that was basically a stage-managed thing. They already knew what they wanted, but they needed to at least make it a little bit difficult. And you know what? So the French brought up some objections to the amount of 20% enriched, blah, blah, blah. And so they put off the, oh, we weren't able to get the deal. And then they went back and they were able to get the deal, the interim deal. So anyway, at this point now, they're not going to go back into secret back channel negotiations in Oman or anything like that. They're already past that point, and that story was already leaked. They're further along than that in the process now anyway. But the point being that it doesn't really matter if the British or the French or the Germans or the Russians or the Chinese are in the room. The real dispute is between the U.S. and Iran. And so if they can work it out, at least chances are great that the Americans can then say, okay, we're satisfied, we have this deal, and you guys sign off on it, and we'll have a deal. Now, is it possible that the French could really sabotage it or anything like that, or any of those actors could? Yeah, I think it is. But I'm trying to be optimistic of this because I'm so sick of this big stupid lie being half a pretext for war all the time. I'm just so damn sick of it. I can't stand it. The Iranian nuclear program is a peaceful nuclear program. It already has been. And we already all knew that. And now Gareth Porter has proved it 115 ways from Sunday in his book, Manufactured Crisis. They never were making nukes at all. And every bit of intelligence, it was so smart, that intelligence that they had. Every bit of data, every bit of information that they thought they had that indicated a nuclear weapons program there has been completely debunked already. All of it has. All of it has been accounted for and explained away, and the IAEA is satisfied, and now we know there's the balancing machine right there at the university, right where they said it was. There are the magnets right there used in this entirely different machine that has nothing to do with nuclear or anything, just like they said it was. It's all been dismissed by Gareth the Great. Go read it yourself. It's a Manufactured Crisis. And so, ironically, as Stephen Walt pointed out back a few months ago, the people who don't believe that the Iran nuclear deal, nuclear program is a problem, are the same ones who want the nuclear deal so bad. And the people who pretend to be so concerned, they're concerned about the deal too. They don't want a deal. They would rather have a problem than a deal. Why is that? It's obvious why I want a deal, because it's a big, fake, stupid, nothing excuse for a Cold War. The last giant fake issue outstanding between our country and theirs, our government and theirs, that they can work out, could work out, that could end this. And that could, you know, really serve to help ratchet down tensions across the Middle East, for that matter. And could be a wonderful thing, could be the beginning of the end of a lot of bad things. How about that? We'll settle for that. Could be the beginning of the end of the Cold War. And it's just a big, fake, stupid, safeguarded issue anyway, so let us dispense with it. But why do the people who are so concerned the Iranians are making nukes, why are they against this negotiation, this deal? Why are they pushing so bad? Why do they want sanctions so bad? Why do they want sabotage so bad? If they're really so concerned that the Iranians might break out and make nukes. They don't want the U.S. government to sign a deal that would guarantee that they don't. Or that they can't within any kind of time period that would make them able to get away with it at all. Which, what the hell? How long does it take to launch all the fighter bombers off an aircraft carrier? A day? 45 minutes? Like Saddam Hussein's mythical chemical weapons? There are constantly American aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf and in the Indian Ocean, and they could launch a war against Iran at any time. And hell, all Diego Garcia's got H-bombs. What the hell was that? Is that coming from the TV? Huh. Oh, I know. Anyway. They got H-bombs piled from here to there at Diego Garcia and could turn all of Persia to glass. As Hillary Clinton said, she would just obliterate them for all time. They were to even look at Israel funny. So how could they possibly make even a single gun-type nuke? It would take them at least, a few weeks? You know? So anyway, I just want to point out that, look, everybody, all this fear-mongering about how irrational those crazy Shiite Muslim irrational types are over there in revolutionary Iran, they're just conservative politicians, just like every other politician in the world is a conservative once he has power and wants to conserve it. They're perfectly reasonable. Just because you can't understand what they're saying when they talk doesn't mean they're madmen. It's just a different language, dude. That's all. You know? And here, when they order their bureaucracy to live up to their specifics of their nuclear deal, they do. Hey, if they're scientific enough to have a nuclear program, they're scientific enough to implement a nuclear deal. Reason. Mathematics. Try it out. You'll like it. It's great. So logically, their nuclear program is safeguarded and safe. And all evidence this entire time since the interim deal has been signed is that they're doing everything right. In fact, today, it's at yahoonews.com, the Associated Press, George John, number one war propagandist against Iran, reported in AP that they have converted their 20% uranium to almost all useless, could not be used for nuclear weapons form. Let's see if Fox News mentions that right now. Not that you can make a bomb out of 20% enriched uranium-235, just that there's this mythology that if you look at 20% enriched uranium-235 funny for a minute, it turns into weapons grade. They don't ever really explain it, but they want you to believe that it's so much easier to make weapons grade uranium out of already 20% than 4% that somehow it's a weapons threat by itself, which is a red herring in the first place. But anyway, they've gone ahead and pretty much gotten rid of all of their 20%. And converted it to powder and to fuel plates and whatever for their medical isotope reactor, just like in the deal. So if you buy the premise that, 20 is a lot higher number than 4%, I guess you got me there, then you can breathe a sigh of relief, according to even George John, who is probably the single most hawkish Western reporter on the Iran issue, to tell you the truth. I would say I'd put him to the right of David Sanger at the New York Times on this. So there. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Join up the chat room if you want. Got a bit of a conversation going on in there. ScottHorton.org/chat. There you go. Yeah, streaming this, that, and the other thing. And again, starting on Monday, back on LRN.FM. It'll be 11 to 2 Texas time, 12 to 3 Eastern. Hope you will tune in on time. All right. Here, let me talk about Afghanistan for a minute. Taliban killed 22 Afghan police in multiple attacks, 40 trapped in the governor's bunker in Badakhshan province. Shan province. Something Shan. Anyway, so there you go. They ended the war, but they didn't defeat anybody. They just said, well, we're ending the war, we're leaving. So, I don't know, man. I guess place your bets about how you think this is going to play out. They say, just like in Iraq, they want to leave 10,000 people behind to train and this and that. But is that what the military is telling the president would be okay? Well, Mr. President, if you leave 10,000 U.S. Army in country there with, you know, some helicopters and some bombs and stuff, then and, of course, plenty of air power, you know, drones and fighter jets, fighter bombers, then, yeah, be fine. Go ahead, and we'll just leave 10,000 there, and we'll do that for the long term, and then you can pass problem off to Hillary or Jeb or whoever's next. There you go. Is that what they said? That 10,000 is enough to do whatever mission they supposedly have there other than just having a mission to stay? Because the government doesn't like losing, even though that's all they ever do is lose? Anyway, I wonder about that. I'm no real military strategist, but, you know, I remember, you might remember, we talked with William S. Lind. He's a military strategist, and he wrote an army back when called How to Lose an Army. And good thing this didn't happen, but what he said was, how about if you surge into Iraq and then dare to strike Iran? Here, they would never admit it, but the facts on the ground for anybody who had eyes to see was that the Americans were fighting for the Shiite Arabs, who were much more loyal to Iran, even though they were much more backed by us. We had our entire army fighting their war for them, the Bada Brigade and the Dawah Party and the Supreme Islamic Council was the umbrella group of the Bada Brigade, and then, of course, the Sadrists, Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army. They were the United Iraqi Alliance of the Shiite Arab majority, backed by Iran and the United States in a giant civil war to put those guys in power for the benefit of Iran. And so then he was saying, now you want to surge against the last of these guys' enemies at the same time you want to strike against Iran? Well, what might happen? And there it was in the record that the Mahdi army, as well as the Bada Brigades, had all vowed that if the Americans attacked Iran, well, they were just going to rise up and kill all the Americans who had been fighting for them all along. Right? Like one giant Benghazi massacre. Our guys in the center of this giant hornet's nest, surrounded. And luckily, they didn't do that. Luckily, Admiral Fallon, probably more than anyone else, stopped Bush from attacking Iran, probably for that reason more than anything else in 2007. But that was what they were messing with. And one of the things that William Lynn said in there was that, hey, you don't think you can lose an army, huh? Guess what? Every general who ever lost an army thought that he wasn't going to lose it the day he lost it. You think you won't lose an army just because you're you? What, because you're exceptional? Maybe for your satellite-guided bombs, if you can get your coordinates right. Maybe. But air power isn't everything. You leave 10,000 guys in Afghanistan with a mission of what? Training up an army that can never stand on its own, ever? You know, subsidizing a coalition of warlords and rapists and killers who could never sustain their power, even with their own brute force. Only on our dime can they have the amount of power and influence that they have now. And is it really the case that 10,000 soldiers can keep the Taliban out of Kabul? Hell, I asked Ann Jones that, and she said, Scott, the Taliban are already in the government, man. This already happened. they ran for election and won. Quite a few of them are in the parliament now. They're part of the government coalition now. So, you know, maybe what'll happen is the Taliban will show up and be like, yep, we're the army of this government, all right. And everything will be their way. It'll be like the softest sacking of Saigon ever. Or maybe it'll be a bloodbath. But they, you know, Obama escalated this war to 100,000 men, and now he's going to bring it back down to 10,000 men and leave, but he didn't win. The whole time, he didn't win. And it seems to me like he's putting those 10,000 guys in danger of being slaughtered, which would be bad politics, Democrats. I can't think of any other reason that you would care at all. So maybe that, huh? Bad politics? The same reason he escalated the war in the first place? Amazing. And of course, the other thing is, they could just stay, right? There's a massive assault. They could just double back down. We need another surge. We're not going to lose Afghanistan. Why not? Who's going to stop them? The American people? They call it the long war. A handful of years, I don't think, is long in the terms they're talking about. Not long enough for the Pentagon. Hey, you try being a general and have your base closed down, you know? I got this whole giant base in Kyrgyzstan, and you guys want to take my base away? But sometimes drugs come through. Maybe we could keep the base and call it the drug war? Can I please keep my base? Cries the tiny general in his costume jewelry. Please don't make me get a real job. I want to have a base in Kyrgyzstan, he wails. It's a hard life, being a general. Having someone try to take your empire away. But anyway, may lose it the hard way. Don't want to listen to reason. I'm surprised that politically they're getting away with this. I don't know, maybe 10,000 guys as armed up with American technology and this and that as it is nowadays, that maybe they can just absolutely bring holy hell to anybody who would come anywhere near them with arms. You know, other than the green-on-blue attacks, the insider attacks, you know, stab-in-the-back attacks from their sock puppet quislings. But, hell, how much does it cost to throw a drone up there armed full of hellfires all day? But then again, the fall of Saigon, I'm pretty sure that wasn't the plan. For it to happen like that. Anyway. And by the way, you know what's funny is Admiral Fallon that stopped the war against Iran, he's also the same guy who said, look, these people are ants. And when the time comes, we will crush them. That's the nicest leader of Central Command ever. That's the guy who stopped the war against Iran. He said, they are insects. Not a one of them has a right to be alive. And when we feel like killing them till we're done killing them, that's exactly what the hell we'll do. But, yeah, I just didn't think it was a good idea this time right now, that's all. That's one of the greatest generals of the last 50 years or something right there. He was an admiral, Navy admiral. Stopped the war. He really did. He said, over my dead body, made it plain that he just absolutely would not count. And it would have been an absolute disaster, especially when you still had tens and tens, 100,000, 100,000+ American soldiers in Iraq. That could have been a real disaster. And, of course, all the bases in Kuwait and in Bahrain and Afghanistan are all within missile range of Iran as well, so careful with, you know, picking a fight over there when you got all your guys right there within missile range. And of course, the Iranians got to be looking at America. Put yourself in Iran's position for just a minute. Imagine you're standing in their spot on the map and you're going, thanks America for overthrowing the Taliban for us. Thanks America for overthrowing Saddam Hussein for us. Suckers, here's your payment, Chalabi. But so why do you want to pick a fight with us? You guys spent the last decade and a half killing everybody we want you to kill. Now you want a regime change here? Now you want to fight on against us? It makes no sense at all. Why did you back the Dawa Party in Skiri in Iraq then? Why did you back Karzai and his friends in Afghanistan then? That's what I would be asking. If I was an Iranian politician, I would be learning English, and I would be asking that question in English all the time. If you guys hate us so much, how come you just threw 5,000 of your own sons' lives away handing Iraq to us, huh, Uncle Dumbass? With your red, white, and blue hat and your big, tough posturing and your big, strong muscles. Ooh, you're muscular. Thanks for handing Iraq to us. Yeah, that George Bush, he's a big, tough guy. He knows just what to do. All right, more complaining. Not much more, though. But more complaining on the other side of this break. Oh, man, and I better hurry, because I got NSA, I got Syria, and Ukraine. So I'm going to not moralize and tell stories. I'm just going to tell you the damn news. Oh, and Iranian spies. Phil Giraldi's got a new one about Iranian spies at the American Conservative. Mossad meets resistance. Did you know that Jeff Stein thing was a three-part series at Newsweek? Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And this is so funny, man. I got out of my right eyeball, I got Josh Block, formerly the press flack for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and still might as well be, citing this Reuters piece saying, no progress in efforts to secure remaining chemical weapons in Syria. Well, so what's the point? That they got rid of almost all of it, but the little bit that's left, some of it has come outside of the government's control. Why? Because the territory's in dispute because of the war that, of course, Josh Block is trying to help incite with this very tweet. Not that the Israeli lobby is interested in pushing America into a war for Al-Qaeda in Syria or anything. Not like they were the only interest group in D.C. pushing for it last summer. Not like they have any interest in overthrowing the Baathists there if they can get you to fight their war for them. And, meanwhile, Syrian Al-Qaeda moving deeper into the Golan Heights. Oh, yeah. Guess who's not willing to respect the deal that you had with Assad? The suicide bombers. Remember last September when Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, explained perfectly well and out loud that the Israeli policy is we prefer Al-Qaeda to Hezbollah because Hezbollah's backed by Iran. Hezbollah's backing the Assad government there, the Shiite government there. And even though America just backed the Shiites against the Sunni jihadists in the war in Iraq, we're now backing the Sunni jihadists against the Shiite government in Syria. And Hezbollah is helping them. And so Oren is saying, hell yeah, man. Bin Ladenites are way better than Ayatollahites. So you're damn right. Yeah, and yet, as I used to always joke, Assad might as well be Mossad. He does exactly what they say. He might as well be their sock puppet. He's caused them no trouble over the Golan Heights this whole time since he's been in power. And if they were smart, he's good at killing Al-Qaeda guys, which you would think that they would prefer. But no, because Hezbollah's backed by Iran. And Iran, they make a great distraction from Israel's policy in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. And so we got to pretend like they're a threat, and so therefore we got to pretend like Hezbollah's a threat, and so therefore we have to really push the Americans into backing Al-Qaeda which is now moving into the Golan Heights and flying their Al-Qaeda flag. Well, F you guys. It's unbelievable. Look at this. 2014, guys. May 22nd, 2014, Al-Qaeda's flag flies over area along Israeli frontier. That's what you get, Ariel Sharon's rotting corpse, for pushing the Americans into war back in '03. It was funner when it was his half-alive zombie comatose corpse laying there. But anyway, and read Bob Dreyfus, Agents of Influence in the Nation, and read the spies who pushed for war. Not that they were the spies, they were the neocons. The Spies Who Pushed for War by Julian Borger in The Guardian. And you can also read James Bamford in A Pretext for War. And there's a few other sources. Karen Katowski could help confirm a little bit of this. But there was certainly an Israeli Office of Special Plans helping create fake intelligence about Iraq in English for stovepiping straight into the neocon vice president's office stream to lie us into war with Iraq. And then, of course, the punchline is that Chalabi was an Iranian agent, and he had his headquarters in Tehran. And there's a great article called How Chalabi Conned the Neocons by telling these idiots, Richard Perle and his lackeys, that this was going to be good for Israel if they could get rid of Saddam Hussein. And I guess in a way you could say it is, because the Iraqi state is much less powerful than it could have been under Saddam and no sanctions, for example. And yet they got Al-Qaeda flags flying on their northern border, so you tell me. Oh, what we need to do is expedite the chaotic collapse, wrote David Wormser, Dick Cheney's Middle East advisor. And then we'll be in a much better position to figure out what how things will shake out next. Oh, you're in a very good position now that you have Al-Qaeda suicide bombers in the Golan Heights. They're much less bad than, say, I don't know, Hezbollah suicide bombers in southern Lebanon, because Hezbollah suicide bombers are backed by Iran. Okay, thanks, Israel. Appreciate it. See, I was going to just cover the news and do less moralizing. So now I just got to go quick. Here's in the Washington Times, U.S. armed rebel group seeks all Syrian land occupied by Israel. These aren't just the direct Al-Qaeda guys. These are the so-called moderates. These are the ones that the U.S. is giving the tow missiles to. And they're saying, Israel, out of the Golan. Meanwhile, we got black Al-Qaeda flags flying on the border. And here, one more like this in the national.ae. Al-Qaeda's rise in southern Syria pushes moderate rebels to the sidelines. And damn it, man, I'm telling you, you already know it. If you heard, I've been on this show and I've been telling you all along, with the help of people like David Enders and Patrick Coburn and others, that this has been Al-Qaeda's war all along. They were a small percentage of the insurgency during the Iraq War. That was mostly the Sunni tribal leaders organizing and running that war on their behalf. They were kind of the extras, the help, and the worst. I mean, they did most of the suicide bombings of the marketplaces and that kind of thing. They're absolutely horrible, but they were still, just numbers-wise, a small percentage of the Sunni insurgency. Not in Syria. This is the jihadist war, hardcore, man. These are, I don't even think there is a Muslim Brotherhood there anymore. I think they all just are the al-Nusra Front, sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri. And the goals of core, original al-Qaeda, which include kill Americans, provoke Americans into intervening more. Like Michael Ledeen always said, turn the Middle East into a boiling cauldron. Like in the Yanan plan, right? Turn all the Arab states upside down, agree Mossad, Iranian intelligence, and Ayman al-Zawahiri, leader of al-Qaeda. Get to work, Americans. You've got your enemy's work to do at their beck and call. All right, now there's going to be an election very soon, supposedly on Sunday in Ukraine. And I don't even think they're going to have the election in the East. It's going to be much more of a boycott thing, and the violence probably is going to get much worse. Because it's only the election, the presidential election is only going to tell the Westerners what they want to hear and tell the Easterners exactly what they expected to hear, which is that their voice doesn't count. Their president's overthrown. The new fake Nazi-backed democracy is going to reelect itself, of course, and they should all go get bent, which is just going to push them further away and could cause a lot of real problems. But now, I guess I'll recommend the battle for Ukraine, who is winning. Not that I endorse every statement in the thing or whatever. It's a very interesting article at the National Interest, the battle for Ukraine, who's winning. But then I have to point this out before the show's over today. This is at CoreyRobin.com, and I don't know who it is, but I don't care. He's quoting this thing on NPR News where they talked about, well, maybe Stepan Bandera wasn't that bad. This guy, and the title is, and now for another view of Hitler. Right, these questions that have already been settled about what's beyond the pale and what's not, well, they're now open to question again. And why? Because America is now on the side of the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese, coincidentally. And so if America's backing the Nazis in Ukraine, then maybe they're not that bad of Nazis, these guys who openly proclaim their affiliation to the Waffen-SS. These guys who proudly proclaim their lineages to Stepan Bandera and his Gestapo goons who murdered thousands of Ukrainian Jews in the Holocaust. And here's NPR going, well, you know, maybe they're not that bad, derp, 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 because we're good liberals and Obama's in power, so we love Nazis, they say, at NPR News. Oh, maybe Nazis aren't so bad anymore. And what's funny here is he brings up this piece by Alexander Coburn about the Lehrer NewsHour, about how they give equal time to both sides and how they're discussing, well, maybe slavery would be all right or whatever. Same thing about Hitler. And next, two views of Hitler. Yeah, that's what you can get listening to NPR, liberal Democrats, Ari Shapiro on NPR, talking all about how maybe Stepan Bandera and the Ukrainian Nazis weren't that bad, and therefore maybe it ain't that bad that these people still praise him and declare his lineages. These people, his lineage, these people who the U.S. is backing now there.